I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Okay, Dad. What? I'm going to challenge you today. Mm-hmm. Let's try and get through a whole episode of the podcast without talking about the following. Brexit. Boris Johnson. Keir Starmer. COVID.
Oh, my God.
I'm bored of talking about it.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, I'll try. Well, listen, actually, it could be possible because thanks to my amazing connections and contacts, I've got you quite a good guest to talk to this week, fellow mental health campaigner. So maybe we can just talk about that.
Yes, exactly. Fellow mental health campaigner. I think we should say this episode of the podcast has lots of mentions of suicide.
Yeah.
For anyone who might feel triggered by that. It's heavy at points, but
it's also quite uplifting, I think.
It's very uplifting. And it happened, young man
who lost a friend to suicide and made a BBC documentary about it, which was brilliant.
He's had a really successful career. He hosts, I can't believe the numbers of people that listen to his show is 900,000 every day.
Wow. Well,
950K.
On Capital.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. And, of course, you also had a lot to talk to him about because you both got kind of megastar dads who are a bit hunky and women like them, yeah?
Yeah, but yeah, I think his dad's more hunky. Oh, I'm joking.
Gold. Oh, which is so it is.
I think being a pop star and an actor is more hunky than being a politician.
Yeah.
Anyway, you're still a hunk and lots of women love you. Okay, let's say who our guest on the podcast is
our
this
guest
week.
Today is Roman Kemp. Can't call my daughter mate just like that, you know.
You know, do you know, like, to be fair, I got called up on that the other day.
Really?
Someone said to me that you can't call girls mate. And they said instantly it's this thing that just is a barrier between you and the girl. And I said, I don't know what you mean. I think it's because I've learned it from my dad. Because my dad calls everyone mate,
male and female.
I think it's just something that I've taken from him. But every now and again, people try and check me to say, no, it's just between guys. You can do that.
That's wild. Anyway, whoever said that is full of shit. That's bullshit. It's much better to call women mate than to presumptuously be like darling or babe. Do you know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
That makes women more uncomfortable when someone's like, you're right, babe. I love being called mate.
I just can't do it. Love, I can't do it.
No, I know. I had a boyfriend that used to say darling and he just couldn't pull it off. It just always made me cringe. I was like, that's what my mum says. Like, stop it.
Well, mum and I didn't call each other darling until we were in our 40s or 50s.
That's good to know. Thank you. Okay, well, I'm really looking forward to this, Roman. I loved your documentary. It was amazing. And everyone I've spoken to about it it was just so well done. But I wanted to start off, we're going to start off a bit more light and then go into some of the more heavy stuff once we've warmed up and gotten you more comfortable with me and my dad's vibe.
yeah, I mean, to be fair, like I've been chatting about this for some time. I'm fully comfortable, but we can start wherever you
no.
want.
No, I mean, do you feel like in any way, does it drain your energy talking about like mental health and suicide, you know, in such an intense way? That wasn't my question, but I am interested to know that.
Yeah. One thing that especially with the documentary, we recorded it from around October and only kind of wrapped 3 weeks prior to transmission date, like to TX. And we actually, around kind of December time, just before Christmas, I actually said to the director, I said to him, I was like, guys, you're going to have to stop. Like, I can't do it anymore. And I said, and we'd had like a lot of visits like set in place. And I said, like, I don't want to do it because what's going to happen is my emotion with it is going to become so detached. You know, when you talk about anything for so long, and then all of a sudden your emotion is away from it and you're not giving yourself the honest answer that you would be giving. You're just kind of going through the motions. Mm. So I really was grateful for the break that they gave me. They gave me basically, we didn't come back until mid-January. And it just gave me time to digest everything that I'd learned so far and then go back and attack it again with the same passion.
Do you think, Roman, if you hadn't done the film about your friend Joe's suicide, do you think you might have done a program about your own mental health anyway?
Well, to be totally honest, I've wanted to make the film given everything that I was dealing with in my own head, but it was a battle with myself in terms of, so I guess selfishly, you know, career wise, you know, what does it do for me? That was one of my worries. It was like, you know, is this something that, am I just going to be known as the kid who, the celebrity kid who says that he gets sad and all these types of things? Like, was it that? And I remember very clearly having the conversation with my mum and dad and basically just saying, I can't do it anymore. I can't sit back on this, you know, this idea and this information that I know and not do anything about it. I've got to do it. And my parents backed me either way. You know, my parents were always like, if I wanted to do it, they'd want me to go and do it. And if I didn't, then that's fine. It's, but it was me, to be totally honest. It was me stopping myself from making it.
But do you feel, I mean, it makes a lot of sense because, like, what you do is about so much, like, lifting people's spirits and being, like, a positive, you know, on your show, being, like, a positive sort of energy. And then it's a bit like when people worry about talking about politics, like, people in the public eye, like, celebrities worry about talking about politics because then they worry that people will see them in a different light. Is that what you worried about, that it would sort of slightly change the way that people saw you? Or was it more nuanced than that?
100%. I mean, it's completely to do with that, you know. Unfortunately, we live in a world where you can get cancelled very quickly, you know, and if you don't go about things in the right way, then you're scolded for it, you know. And it was something that it was playing in my head a lot in terms of, you know, was it the right timing to make this documentary? Mm. You know, and I thought about it for a while. And then when Joe died, it just felt like nothing mattered. This was the most important thing and I had to tell people. And it was like, I was just like, I've got to do it. Like, it just felt like a, you know, like a piece of paper that I had to show everyone.
Mm. Jerome, and I've had suicidal ideation, and I've also had a cousin who took his own life in the year 2000, and so I've always been interested in suicide. And so Joe took his own life, and I have this depression scale, which is 1 is kind of manic, out of control, and 10 is suicide. And I've only ever reached, well, I might have been at 1 once, so I've only ever got as low as 9, which is like really, really thinking about it. Have you been 9?
Yeah. I mean, that's the horrendous thing is that people can be at a 10 and you would never know. And I think that the nine has been that nine number that you talk about there. I'd say I've been there a couple times, I think, in my adult life. And it's something that if I recognize I'm getting to that point, if I tell the right people, then when it gets to that point, those people are there for me. And understanding of one, what it is that I think that I'm going through, which at that point seems like the whole world is collapsing. And two, they're just there. They're physically there. And I'm really, really lucky. You know, in the film as well, I speak to my mum about it, about a moment in particular where, you know, she was there for me. And I think that it was really important that we showed that. And I never really had told her the extent of it in terms of the ideations, as you were saying there. But it was important that we put that in. And I remember saying to the BBC and the director and everyone involved in the documentary, I was like, look, if we're going to do this, it has to be as shocking as possible. Like it has to be, I will tell my mum exactly what I was thinking there and then, because people need to know the reality of what thoughts are going through your head. It's fine to go and say, you know, I felt really sad, and you know, mum, you called me and everything got better. I wanted to be able to go, no, mum, I felt so sad that this is what I was thinking about. And to show, you know, my mum, I guess, the reality of it.
I think the thing that has really lingered with me since I watched your documentary is that terrible feeling that someone could have been suicidal and you would have just had no idea, even if you were incredibly close to them. And often it is that thing of, you know, what could I have done? And especially those boys from Northern Ireland, I just fell in love with all of them. They were so sweet and insightful and so young. And I just thought, God, they'll, you know, like you, live with that forever and think, what could I have done? I guess what I'm trying to say now is, like, you know, we all know that this is a huge problem among men in particular because of the way that gender roles are sort of set, that women are more likely to talk about their feelings. But what, since doing the documentary, what have you kind of realised now? Like, what are things that we can tell boys to do to be there for their friends and to also be able to, I guess, open up?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an incredibly difficult thing. I think, as you said there, you know, I only know it, you know, and your dad will only know it from being a guy. It's almost kind of ingrained in you from the moment you step inside a school that us as guys, we don't cry, we don't chat about those types of things. You know, it's a sign of weakness. And I think what I saw from the lads in Northern Ireland, and I think what I've seen from everyone that I met within making this documentary was one, lads love a challenge. They love a challenge. And now after this, I wanted the onus to shift from the person that is suffering onto the people around them. Because realistically, and again, I can only speak from personal experience, when you're in that place as a guy, the last thing that you are going to be willing to do is talk if you're not prompted. And so what it needs to be is it then needs to be the mates that have that responsibility. And what I saw from the Northern Ireland lad was the Irish lads were, they loved that thing of, you know, he's my mate, I'm going to protect him. You know, and in some ways they're protecting themselves by being like that, because they're constantly talking. And because they have that challenge now of, okay, I need to be the hero here. I need to be what they believe is, you know, a man. And maybe that is some form of toxic masculinity. But realistically, what they're doing is they're talking about their feelings, but they feel like they're doing it in a way which is saving one another.
And how do you, when you were... No, I was going to say just... I've always observed that, like, men make their girlfriends their therapists, basically. That's what's always happened in my life and my friends' lives, is that they'll get into a relationship with women and then offload everything onto them, and then it's such a burden on them. But when you were younger, did you have that relationship with your male friends, or was it a bit more typical?
Well, I guess the female person that I would bounce off would always be my mom. Mm-hmm. And that's because she literally used to force me. I have one friend who you know, you see in the documentary, his name's Charlie. And Charlie, he lost his mom at a really young age. And then, well, basically she was, you know, suffering from cancer for about 7 years. And when he first heard, you know, I was pretty open with him. I told him that I was taking, you know, antidepressants when I was around 15. And then when he kind of went through a tough time, I was the person that he came to because he couldn't, you know, he had these ideas in his head and he didn't understand what was going on. And he came to me. And ever since then, he and I have always held that relationship. You know, he's my best mate. And, you know, we play that role to each other. You know, I've got him, he's got me. You know, and that's what we kind of do. So I've always been lucky that I've had that friend, per se. But something that what you're saying there is, and I think this is something that I've really tried to push because my audience, if you can call it that, is the main demographic would be girls. You know, if you were to go on my Instagram and say who's the what, you know, what gender and what age you're following your demographic, it's girls from the ages of 16 to 35.
Is that the same on the radio? Do you have a very female following on the radio?
I think it's a little bit more equal. It's a little more equal on the radio, but I think on Instagram, I think Instagram is very much so female skewed. Mm. And so, you know, for me, it's more a question of people. The question that people ask me is, my boyfriend's having a tough time. What should I do? You know, I know my boyfriend is telling me all these things and you know, I'm worried about him, genuinely worried about him. And there's this kind of line that guys have, and I think girls have it less so. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but we decide to tell our partners certain things that we don't tell our friends. But then there's things that we tell our friends that we don't tell our partners. And there's also things that we have that we tell our parents that we don't tell our friends or our partners. And those lines are so strict.
And there's loads that you don't tell your parents.
Yeah, exactly. And those lines are very strict, I think, when it comes to men. And I think that if a girl is experiencing a situation whereby they're genuinely worried about their boyfriend or they feel low or they seem down, let me tell you are in no way doing a bad thing by explaining that to their friends, to your boyfriend's friends. And that would be my first thing. It would always be go to the friends. It wouldn't be go to the parents. It wouldn't be, you know, try and sort it yourself. Because look, as you know, I'm one of those people, granted, you know, I'm someone that, you know, I will always try and believe that I can solve the scenario, you know, and realistically for a guy, that has to come naturally from their friends. So I would always say, if there's a girlfriend that's in that situation, speak to your boyfriend's best friends and just tell them everything. You're not doing your boyfriend a disservice by being honest.
I was very struck by one scene in particular in the documentary when you were sitting around the table with your mum and your dad and your sister, and your dad kind of opened up, and it seemed to me that he was opening up in a way that you were really quite taken aback by just how open he was. And that surprised me because you've been open to the, you know, to the extent of making films about it. And yet, and your dad's, you know, for those, I'm sure most of the people listening know that your dad was, you know, big star in Spandau Ballet, EastEnders, Martin Kemp, did the craze, all that. And yet you seem quite moved, but quite taken aback about how open he was about how he'd struggled.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's exactly what you're saying. My dad is someone that people say, oh, you know, you and your dad are so close, like you must chat about this, this and that. And I think because I had such a relationship with my mum, with my mental health, I realised that I'd never actually sat down and had that chat with my dad to the extent of we did it that night. And I guess I'm really proud of my dad for one, being a part of, you know, the film with me and being there for me, and two, telling me the reality, you know, hearing him say to me, right, I don't understand it sometimes, you know, and it wasn't a talked about thing when I was a kid, you know, and then him kind of opening up about the terrible things and the terrible thoughts that he would have, you know, whilst he was suffering with his brain tumors and the therapy that he required after that. And it's so funny because, you know, a lot of the things that he was saying, you know, he talks about being in a bubble and that people outside of that bubble don't understand your feelings. And that's exactly what I was feeling at the time. And, you know, I never felt that maybe he wouldn't understand that. Maybe he didn't understand it. But it's nice because, you know, now that conversation has been had between my family. It's, you know, I was taken aback by it yesterday, you know, because he was talking about someone. I can't remember. He was talking about, I don't know, a celebrity. And he said, he goes, you know, you got to think. He said to me, you know, brother, you got to think there's a lot of people out there that have shared the same thoughts that you've had in your life. And even just hearing him say that, giving recognition to the kind of thoughts that I've had and the struggles that I've had, makes such a difference, I think, from a guy's perspective, to hear that from your own dad. You know, It was validating in a way.
You had a really, you know, interesting child in a way, because both your parents were famous. You know, your dad famous, your mum. My favourite fact I dug up when I was digging around, reading up on you, was that you're probably the only person in the world, both of whose parents were in the Wham! Last Christmas video, right? So,
yeah.
So what was, you know, so you've grown up with famous parents. You've, that, as Grace will tell you, brings its own pressures at times. But how do you think that has affected your well-being and your mental health? Do you think that has had an impact?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's just I think one thing that I've realized in this whole thing is that, you know, no one case of any form of mental health is the same as someone else, because everyone, you know, causes their own problems within their heads at some point. And do I think that that was a pressure that I put on myself in terms of, am I going to live up to them? Yeah, probably. You know, you feel a responsibility. I think still in that toxic masculinity world, I still think, oh, you know, I've got to carry on the Kemp name. You know, I've got to carry on this idea that Kemps are successful and we're good people and we do this and we have a family and we provide for families. And yeah, I think that definitely had an impact, but you have to remember, like, and, you know, Grace, you can say this as well, like when people ask you, you know, what's it like having a dad that people know who they are? You're born with it. You don't know anything different. So you've kind of got, there's no other side. All you see is similarities. You know, all you see is someone saying, I'm really upset about this. And no matter what it is, that feeling is, if that feeling is real, then you share that feeling no matter what the main problem is.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, like, on gender. I always thought I would have hated to be my dad's son, and I'm happy I'm his daughter, because the complexities that come from being the son of a prolific man as a man, because of toxic masculinity and the way that men are kind of pressured to, I don't know, I've never envied my brothers for being men, and I think I benefited so much more from being slightly distanced from it. So it's nice in a way that you can now, and probably it's from growing up, be able to separate yourself from it. But did you grow up in London, Roman?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where did you go to school?
So we grew up in Muswell Hill.
Oh, right near us.
Yeah. And then my dad started doing EastEnders. So we had to go a little bit further out to, like, Hertfordshire way. And then I would get the bus, which is like an hour away from my house, all the way to school in Buckinghamshire.
Oh, wow. So, were there, like, did you grow up around other kids of famous people?
No. That was the thing. Like I'd already, like, I'd been, you know, at the end of the day, like, my cousin's dad is famous. Do you know what I mean? And my, you know, I have, you know, you meet people all the time who have famous, you know, parents or whatever. I guess it was always less so, you know, how famous the person, it was always the relationship that they held with their parent. And because my parents have always held this kind of, equality line with me and my sister. You know, we're all just mates. You know, it was never a case of, oh, I'm going to, you know, punish you if you don't do your homework or all this type of stuff. It was always just a thing of, if you do that, that would upset me. And I'm your friend. Would you want to upset your friend? And I think because we just kept that level of respect between each other, there was never that kind of sense of rebellion that I see within other celebrity kids sometimes.
I was just going to say whether you ever felt, because I sometimes feel that this with my children, you know, less so now maybe, but I can remember when they were growing up, sometimes I felt that they were really pissed off that when I was out and about or when I was working at home, or whatever, they were having to kind of share me and not own me and not be with me in the way that they wanted to be. And I've always carried quite a lot of guilt about that. And I wonder whether you felt that with your dad in particular.
I can honestly say I never did. I think I've always held both my parents in huge, huge like regard. And I love and I'm so proud of my parents for everything that they've achieved. And I really, you know, I couldn't admire them more. You know,
Grace, this is where you meant to say me too, me too, me too, Grace. Come on.
I don't want to interrupt.
Oh, sorry.
It was true, you know, it's true. And I think are those things that my dad worried about as a father? I think 100%. I think 100%, you know, my dad has, you know, has worked so much and has given his life, you know, to make other people have entertainment, etc. You know, did he feel like that? You know, when he was out with the band, you know, when he first met my mum, did he feel like that? I'm sure he did. And I'm sure those are things that, you know, later on down the line, I probably as a father will feel.
I think that
George Michael's your godfather.
Yeah, exactly.
How many times have you name dropped that in your life, do you think?
The thing is, you don't really need to name drop it. I mean, one, everyone seems to know it. And then two, at the same time, it's the same, Grace. It's like, you know, when people say to you again, what's it like having a famous dad? It's
yeah, but Grace, why don't you tell him about your best godfather name drop?
Well, I used to rotate who my godfather was. It was like Alex Ferguson for a while, because we're obviously not religious, but like whoever my dad's best mate was at the time, I'd be like, yeah, Fergie's my godfather. I thought that would get me a boyfriend in secondary school, and it didn't.
But yeah, like that's it. Like, but to be fair, you know, with George, you know, I love George like my uncle. You know, he was a part of my family in the exact same way, and I always find it, you know, it's just a part of your life, and you grow up with that being the normal. You know, to me, the name George Michael doesn't say insanely famous person. It is my mum's best friend, you know, and in the same way that your dad probably has his best mates, and you know them, and you open them you show them kind of open arms into your family. It's the same thing. And I think with George, that's always the same, you know. It's okay, George, what we did for Christmas. Okay, George is coming over on this
that's
day.
That's so cool. You spent Christmas with the King of Christmas. That's so cool.
I know. But it's mainly
watching the EastEnders Christmas special.
You joke. That man was the most obsessed with EastEnders of everyone in my family.
Wow. Well, this is becoming very relatable, this podcast.
Exactly. Very relatable.
Did you ever worry about... No, Dad, I'm asking a question. Thank you. Did you ever worry when you started working of that, you know, I've had a lot of feelings of like, oh, people just think I'm doing this because of who my dad is. And did you get that weird feeling at the beginning of your career that you were guilty of nepotism?
100%. I think that lends itself to, you know, your kind of your thoughts. You know, it was one of the thoughts that I've always had in my life. But at the same time, I firmly believe that now I'm in a job that if you can't do it, you get found out.
Yeah, completely.
if you can't host a radio show, you get found out if you're just there because of your dad.
No, totally.
Yeah, but I think, look, when I first announced that I was doing this documentary, I had a mixed reaction. The first reaction was, oh yeah, amazing, great, what a great cause. And the second was, you know, what do you know? You've never had, you know, to go through the hardships of life. You know, you've always had this great, you know, this, and that. And let me tell you, I'm the first person to explain that I have had the most privileged, looked after life ever. I have had the most incredible parents who are still together. I've got the best schooling was given to me. Any present that I wanted when I was a kid was always given to me. And do you know what? I'm still so proud of it, and there's not one thing that I'd change. And when I saw that kind of come in, that's just part of my life now to see those kind of messages. And I've always just kind of set it as a bar of like, okay, judge me after you've seen what it is that I want to put out there, or judge me after I've done the radio show. Then tell me that I'm there because of my dad. And you know, my dad and my mom have always been there to not let me get down on those types of comments. But one of the funniest things about it was Josh Allott, who is the director of.
We know Blue. Josh. He worked with Paddy with our dad. Sorry.
Yeah. So Josh Allott, like when I first got these messages come through saying, oh, nepotism, you know, why is he hosting this? Josh's mum is Annika Rice. And so I sent him a text and I go, oh God, wait until they see who's directing it. I said, me and Josh are going to make a football team called Nepotism FC.
Yeah, I nearly wrote a whole comedy show called Nepotism and name dropping.
Yeah, exactly.
Just going back to, I want to talk a little bit about the theme of grief, because I mean, you know, we saw a lot of your grief in the documentary related to Joe. But then you'd also been through that situation with George Michael, which was, you know, as you say, your mum's best friend. It's a big thing in your life. And it's very, very public. Now, in a way, you've made the grief about Joe public because it's a documentary, but you've done it very much on your terms. You know, you've been able to kind of reflect that as you want. Whereas something like George Michael died, which, you know, so many people feel they own that. And, you know, here's a real name drop. I can remember talking to Prince William about how he felt, but that thing about when you feel that the public, you know, he once said to me, seriously, he said that when he was walking behind the coffin and he felt almost angry that all of these people who were crying, who never even knew her, and he was like her son and he wasn't meant to cry. Now, I just wonder I wonder what the difference is in that grief that you felt where you've, the public sharing of it, and then the very private when it's like your best mate.
Yeah, I think that my view on those things, you know, is when it came to George passing, was I always was pushed by my mum to feel just more pride. You know, more pride in the fact that, wow, look how incredible he is, that he has touched this many people in their life. Maybe if they were going through a tough time, maybe if it was a moment in their history, maybe the song that these people danced to at their wedding, it was the song that was conceived when their child was conceived, you know, those types of things. And I completely understand. And do you know what? Like, it's an odd thing. It's a very odd thing, you know. The death of anyone, of a family member, is very, very strange.
Mm.
And to see it on the news is very odd, you know. But I think when it comes to George, I was always just, you know, my mum just said, you know, look, bro, look how many people he changed their lives, you know, and that's something I can only be proud of him for.
And the grief with Joe, do you think that will ever go?
The grief with Joe is really hard. Do you know that the main thing was, and I went to go and see him the other day. I visited the church where he is, and I sat there, and you know, I said to him, I was like, you know, we did it. You know, I felt him with me the whole way through that documentary, and again, it was more so, I wasn't there to kind of show people, you know, grieve with me for my friend and, you know, oh, I'm passing this grief to other people. It was more so, again, I'm really proud of him. and I'm really proud. And if some by messed up divine intervention, if everything is meant to happen for a reason, then look how many lives he's affecting right now. You know, the amount of people that have reached out and opened up since I told Joe's story is phenomenal. And even we got the stat back, which was hotline searches in terms of male suicide were up by 760%.
Wow.
Straight after the documentary.
On the night,
straight after the doc. And that for me, like, just makes me so proud of him and grateful of him that's the situation that we're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because, you know, we can only deal with, there's only so much I can go back and say, look, you know, what could I have done? But the reality of the situation is Joe's not here anymore. And, you know, I'm so grateful to his family for allowing me to tell his story. And you know, you're seeing tangible results here. Mm. You know, I spoke to his family afterwards and they were so overwhelmed because they can see that their son has quite literally saved lives, whether or not he knows it or not.
Mm.
You know, and you can see that. And I think that's more relevant to me than any form of jealousy that I could have of people saying, oh, I knew Joe as well. Like, doesn't matter.
Mm. What do you want to do with the, you know, you're obviously, whether you like it or not now, you're going to be like kind of very big in the mental health campaign field. What do you want to do with this?
I'd love to see, I know Dr. Alex has recently got his brand new role within the government, but I'd love to see it just implemented inside the curriculum of schools. That's my main thing. I would love for in the curriculum of a school there to be something that's representative of mental health and the realities of things like suicide.
Mm.
I would love for, even if it's not anything to, you know, I'm very aware of, I'm not someone that is a campaigner to lobby government. I'd much rather, if parents want to take that responsibility, I'd rather speak to the parents, because at the end of the day, I didn't go to a school that spoke about mental health, but I'm still here, you know, and that's because of the relationship that I feel like I have with my parents and the household that they bring me up in. And, you know, there's a lot of studies, you know, that Dr. Rory O'Connor, who I speak to in the film from Glasgow, he says to me, he's like, Roman, it needs to start in the womb, reinforcing positive mental health to your child, reinforcing that idea that no matter what thought they have, they're heard, and no matter what feeling that they feel is valid. And that's something that you know, you can't, there's only so much you can do to the government to, you must know this, you know, there's only so much campaigning you can do before something gets changed.
But as well, it's like what you said earlier, you know, your family came across so well in the documentary, and I was listening to you on this other podcast, and the woman hosting it said that you have, like, everyone says that your family are just like lovely people. And it sound, and that way that you were raised to be equals, and the sort of mutual respect of your feeling is always valid. That's definitely how I plan on raising my children, and how, Dad, you should raise your children like that as well. I think it'd be really helpful for all of your other younger kids if you implemented that now. It's too late for us.
Yes. So what, the five-year-old or the
Your family in Australia, the family in Albania, you know, he's got many families.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But you're saying I failed as a parent, is that what you're saying?
Say that again?
You're saying I failed you as a parent.
I honestly can't remember. You weren't there that much. I don't remember, like, you parenting me. It was Anna the nanny.
Shit.
What, it's true?
Yes.
Ask my therapist. Roman, do you do therapy?
I do, but only when I feel like I need it.
Okay. Like my dad.
I feel like I need it. I'm very honest with myself. And you know, I'm very honest with myself, I think, when it comes to that. And I am like, okay, this is probably a scenario whereby I need to talk to someone else that's removed from everything. I love therapy. I think therapy is a fantastic thing. I hate the idea that people now still believe that therapy is this thing where you sit in a chair lying down like that and you cry and all this stuff and people tell you how you should feel. When the reality is they're incredible people that help you lead yourself to your own answers.
But I do think as well, this is something that infuriates me about men, is I've decided I'm never going to have a boyfriend that will straight up say, I'm not doing therapy. And I have been with men who've said, I will never do therapy. And I'm like, that's such a red flag, because you don't know at what point it will become necessary for you to do therapy. But men have this idea that it's some kind, well, a lot of men, not all men, have this idea that it's like some form of failure to go and see a therapist, when actually it's a luxury. I mean, it's the coolest thing in the world. Someone just listens to you.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's don't get me wrong, it's a very expensive activity, and I'm very privileged to be able to do it. But, you know, then I have to think about those men that have said that to you. I know for a fact my dad was one of those men, and it took him to go through what he went through. And my mum, do you know what actually happened? I think my mum says it, my dad says it in the thing. My mum basically tricked my dad and sent him to a chiropractor who was actually a therapist. And so my dad would go to these chiropractic sessions that were to help his joints after he was getting over lying in a hospital bed for so long. And the chiropractor was actually a trained therapist and would talk him through things at the same time, kind of subtly almost. You know, and yeah, it is a red flag for sure, because you've got someone that is like, I think anyone that says categoric no's to anything is a red flag in someone. You know, I think being open and being willing to try things is a great thing and a rare thing to find in people these days. But certainly I don't think it can necessarily define someone, I guess, is what I'm saying. Some people have to find their own path.
I don't know if your family do this, but certainly when I sometimes go into a plunge, Fiona, Grace's mum, and sometimes maybe Grace will say, what triggered it? What caused it? Why do you get depression? And I never ever know the answer. But do you, you know, as you say, you've had a really nice family, really nice upbringing, young, successful, all that stuff. Do you, when you say to yourself, where does the depression come from? What's the best answer you've found for yourself?
The best answer I found was I went to the doctor and I took a lot of tests trying to figure out how much serotonin my body releases and in terms of blood types and all these different things that they pull up. And they basically told me there and then that it was a chemical form of depression, that my brain wasn't releasing enough of those hormones. And I think that there's good and bad parts to that, because there's bad parts because nothing can happen. The best things around you could be happening and you look miserable. And you can't help it. You really can't help it. And you can't help, you know, anxieties taking over. The good part is that you're understanding of it and you see it as something that's just part of my body, you know, in the same way that my body doesn't work in the way that a professional footballer's work, and I'm not a professional footballer. My brain is not a professional, you know, happy person.
Yeah. So you see it very much as a chemical.
I mean, what about you? Yeah, I mean, you know, what about yourself? I mean, you know, you say that sorry, I just kicked the glass. You know, you say that you feel like you don't know where it comes from. I mean, is that something that you've looked into, whether or not it's a chemical form of depression or is it something else?
I've sort of looked into everything and I still don't really know the answer. If I look at my life in an objective way, I think, well, you know, it ought to be okay. But so I just feel it's kind of part of my wiring that, and I also think, you know, back to the scale, I also think that it's part of the positive side of me as well. I think it's what gives me, you know, when I'm coming out of a depression, I feel energy like a, you know, just a rush of energy and creativity and power as well sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. Whenever it comes down on me and Fiona says, what happened? I just don't know the answer.
I remember when I was like 15 or 16, I had really bad, I was clearly pretty insane, and have been since then. But my mum tried to make me go and see a therapist, and I just refused it for years because I was like, if I go and see a therapist, people will think I'm boring because the madness in me is what people love and find really quirky. And then if I see a therapist, they'll iron that out. And so I really got worried about what, so much of my identity was wrapped up in being this kind of unreliable, up and down kind of mad person. And actually, none of that goes away if you do therapy. You just work out where some of your shit's coming from. But it's,
and then you turn it into a comedy sketch.
Yeah. But or you learn to channel it. But what I was going to say is, like, I really appreciate some of the characteristics that my bad mental health has given me. Like, it's given me a sense of empathy towards other people. I always am super aware of how other people might be feeling in a situation. If someone goes a bit like that, I'm like, oh, they're having a panic attack or something else is going on there. Because it's once you've experienced it, you know what that feels like. Whereas when you've never had it, like my mum, it's very hard to articulate to her what it feels like because it sounds a bit crazy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it really informs a lot of good things about us. Anyway, that's just my trying to get this onto a bit more of a positive note because
it's all positive.
So Roman,
and also I've got to say, Roman, we quite often get quite a lot of publicity for our podcast, but I don't think we've ever been in the Daily Star. So can you sort of just talk us through your love life right now?
But this is what I was going to say. You're quite in just the tabloids.
Sorry, say that again.
You're quite.
Just give us a couple of new names.
Yeah, up and comers, Roman. Who are the up and comers?
Do you know what? Honestly, it's something that doing a breakfast show. I said this the other day. I am far too tired to date. Every time
in a pandemic, like, as well.
It's just like honestly, I think, you know, I've done it all. I've done the dating apps, I've done, you know, like chat to people on Instagram, all that type of stuff. But when it comes to actually meeting up with people, maybe it's just me at the moment, but I'm just like, I can't be bothered. Like, I honestly can't.
Grace, we've got a story. Roman breaks a million hearts. I can't be bothered with any of you.
But no, you know what? I really genuinely feel like, I kind of feel like I'm you know, realistic, who is my girlfriend and who am I married to? I'm married to, selfishly, my show. You know, and that's the thing that, you know, the reason I don't drink during the week, the reason I try my best to go to bed early, and the reason why I you know, try and do what I do is to make that show sound as good as possible. And I love the radio show. And, you know, if a girlfriend got in the way of that, they'd be gone.
Yeah, well, it's like when you come to a relationship with a child from a previous relationship. It's, you know, it's me or the kid, and that that I can imagine.
Grace, I always put you before the job, Grace. Always.
That's fucking bullshit. It's why I'm so fucked up. Anyway, don't worry about it. No, but I think also, Roman, you've had a crazy year, and you've been through so much, and then you've been working throughout a pandemic. And so you have to just give yourself a break. Like, why do you need to date right now? You don't. You need to just have some time off. And then, you know, once we can all party again, it will just be more natural. I went for a breakup in the midst of the pandemic, and it was very, very challenging, to say the least.
I did. No, I split up with my girlfriend of 3.5 years during the pandemic, and it's horrible. It's really horrible. You know, in a way, I'm grateful for the pandemic in that sense, because it kind of gives you a realistic view on how life's going to be. You know, it forces you to push your relationship 5 years down the line.
How do you like working with your dad, by the way? You work with your dad now as well, don't you?
Yeah, mate, I absolutely love it. And that's, again, everything I do is always based around my family, like in the future. And the reason why I wanted to do stuff with my dad, and the reason why, you know, Grace, you'll look back on this podcast so fondly, it's because you will tell your kids and show their grandkids and say, look what me and your granddad did.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Archive. That's why I love doing it. The process of doing it is not fun, but I love having... No, just working with my dad, it's not how you just describe working with your dad. It's a fucking nightmare. But I'm joking, Dad. At the beginning, it was a complete nightmare, but we've eased into it. But... having an archive of your relationship is so cool.
Oh man, I love it. I really love it. And you know, even just little things like with Gogglebox and you know, with Weekend Best, our show on ITV, I love it. I love the fact that, you know, and again, like, listen, I'm so proud of my dad, and my dad is still the person that I, you know, my dad and my mum are the people that I hold in the highest regard ever. And if I can do anything to enjoy those moments and see them doing their thing with them, then I'm there. You know,
are you musical, by the way? Are you musical?
Yeah. So the funny story that always kind of shocks people is that when my dad, after my dad had his brain tumor, he forgot all of his bass lines to Stand Up Ballet. And since I grew up, like my sister's a songwriter, and my dad and my mum always used to make sure that I was only allowed to sing in the car if I sang in tune or did the harmony with her or whatever. And then my dad taught me bass and taught me guitar. And so when it came back to Spandau Ballet going back out on tour, he was completely honest with me. He was like, "Ro, I can't work them out. Can you teach me them?"
Oh, that is so sweet.
Yeah, you know, and that memory of me and him, and I was only 16, that memory of me and him sat in my room, both with a bass guitar and me saying to him, "Dad, it's this, it's this, it's this," is one that I'll always hold really dearly.
That's really sweet. That's like me teaching my dad how to use Instagram, but he still doesn't get it.
No, it's like you trying to teach me the bagpipes after I've lost my memory. And I've got the least musical family of any great musician, which I truly am.
Yeah, we are a very unmusical family. We just got mum's genes. Anyway, we're funny, so that's fine. Well, Roman, it's been a complete pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us.
No, it's been great. Really good. Is Roman our youngest? Is Roman our youngest ever?
How old are you, Roman? 27?
28.
Oh, wow,
Scarlett,
happy birthday.
It's his birthday.
No, well, I'm the youngest guest.
How old are you?
I'm 26.
Okay. Well, you still hold the being the youngest then.
Yeah. Roman, I'm going to follow in your footsteps and do I'm a Celeb, and then I'm going to fucking break so many hearts in the UK. It's crazy.
Exactly.
Roman, can I thank you as well, Roman, for being in your 20s and a young person and not swearing once in this podcast, unlike other young people.
Listen, I'm still like with my dad. My dad always kept that rule in the house. I was allowed to swear at the football, but I'm not allowed to swear.
But also, you've got a morning radio show. You're used to not being able to swear. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've had, whenever I go on the radio, I get Ofcom complaints because I'm not used to not being able to swear.
Yeah.
And I'm a very, very, very bad example.
You're a very bad example. You swear all the time, and then you wonder why I do it to impress you, and then it doesn't impress you.
I tell you what, Roman, just do one little bit that we're not going to that won't be in the podcast. But just say, Tyler. Just say that.
Oh, this is my best friend. No, she'll be so upset about that, Dad. Don't do that. My best friend.
I wish I said you've got a friend that's in love.
Yeah, she really fancies you, and she's also just gone through a breakup. She was like, "Just tell him I love him, but not in the podcast, because my ex-boyfriend will get angry."
Tyler, hello. Maybe when this is all finished, we can go for a drink.
Yeah,
there you go. He's asked you out, Tyler. All right, Roman. Listen, that was really good. Did it.
You did it.
Did it, didn't do the B word, didn't do the J word, didn't do the Trump word, didn't do the Biden word, didn't do the Brexit word, didn't do the COVID word.
Was that a conscious thing? Did you find yourself wanting to and not, or did you feel the conversation just didn't really go that way?
No, I felt if he'd have sort of said, you know, because it's the first time I've ever met him, right? If he'd have said halfway through, by the way, you know, I'm really political on this, then it would have gone that way. But no, I really enjoyed talking to him, and I thought he was great.
Do you think because of his job, he can't be too political?
No, I don't know.
It's not like the BBC, obviously, Capital, but...
Possibly, but I just didn't... No, I thought he had so much to say about... He his background, about his family, about his friend, about his own mental health, about youth, about growing up with famous parents. He just had a lot to say, and I really enjoyed talking to him.
Me too. Yeah, he's a really, really nice guy.
Mm.
And will, you know, continue to have lots of success, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, and then he also had, you know, we didn't even talk about the program he had on this week about his, you know, DNA history, which was on ITV. That was good as well. I really liked that.
Yeah.
No, I thought it was really, really, really liked him. And I just think, well, as you know, I'm very big on young people's energy and the need to get it out there. I think he'll be a great addition to the whole kind of mental health.
I agree. I mean, I think as well, like, the things that really, really do have an impact are young men, because it's just so much more of a problem amongst young men.
It sounds great. So what, I should retire?
No, I'm saying... I'm saying that's where that the mental health world needs to be more saturated with young men, with young men with a profile like Roman Kemp, because he's got a huge audience. So it just will have a massive knock-on effect on other people, I think.
Now, do you think we need to talk a little bit about...
Brexit, COVID? No, absolutely not. I think we should end this by saying, if you haven't watched the documentary, Roman Kemp's documentary about his friend Joe... who took his own life last year, and it's just a really, really powerful documentary about
and it's suicide. It's on the BBC iPlayer.
It's on iPlayer, and it was to raise money for Comic Relief.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Comic Relief, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, yeah, it was part of the Comic Relief like campaign, because they fund lots of the the places, the suicide places. Okay, well, thank you so much, Dad, and I hope you have a great life.
All right, I'll go upstairs and talk. By the way, I've got a book out today. And
oh, my God!
God, so you didn't even mention it.
Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. It's just, come on. Sorry.
I know.
You had Living Better was a big deal.
No, but also, this is just so weird.
How many volumes have you done?
This is number 8.
Yeah.
But the point is, though, it's just like, I think, I'm trying to, one of the volumes, I launched at the Festival Hall or some bloody place.
Now
you just have to do bits of online this and that.
Well, look, you're doing great, sweetie. So thank I'm you, really dear. Proud of you.
Thank you, dear.